This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio, and here is what's coming up.
And this drought is actually worse than the drought of 2011, where we had 250,000 people lost their life.
That's UNICEF Somalia representative Wafa Saeed on the dire situation in Somalia from a severe drought. Also, a roadside bomb in northern Burkina Faso has killed at least 35 people, and Chad is battling flood from the heaviest rains in 32 years. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. At least 35 people were killed, dozens of others wounded in Burkina Faso when a vehicle in a convoy hit a roadside bomb yesterday. It's the latest in a string of deadly attacks in the West African country. No one has claimed responsibility for the blast, but the country has faced hundreds of attacks from Islamist groups. Dr. Daniel Aizenga, an expert on the Sahel with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says there are many factors fueling the violence in Burkina Faso, but the primary one is a militant Islamist insurgency that began targeting the region in 2016.
Over the last 6 years, it's really ramped up. So we've seen these militant Islamist groups target soft targets like hotels or, you know, sort of populated areas and urban centers to becoming much more of a rural insurgency. And in these last 2 years, it's really accelerated. The security situation has deteriorated so much so that, you know, nearly 2 million people have been displaced from their homes. And just for context, Burkina Faso has a little more than 20 million citizens. And so, you know, you're talking about almost 1 in 10 people being displaced. Militant Islamist groups have been targeting these thoroughfares. And so they've been laying IEDs. And when they target the military as well as civilian convoys, they're really just trying to prevent people from being able to use those corridors as for transportation.
Well, what are these groups? And mostly I take it they're linked with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. What do they want in Burkina Faso? And are they and not just in Burkina Faso in the Sahel?
Sure. So this is where things get a little bit messy and complicated. There are militant Islamist groups operating in the region that profess their allegiance, if you like, to Al-Qaeda. There is a group in the region called Islamic State in Greater Sahara, which has pledged its allegiance to Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And so there are these global connections, at least in terms of communication strategies and media, but it's less clear when you're talking about sort of financial support or other material supports or foreign fighters coming to Burkina Faso or neighboring countries. That we haven't really seen those types of connections or dynamics evolve in this particular theater. And to your question, it doesn't just concern Burkina Faso. It also concerns the neighboring countries of Mali and Niger. These three countries have really been kind of the epicenter of this rural insurgency for the last 3, 4, 5 years.
Who are the main targets of these attacks? I mean, are they intentionally going after civilians?
In some instances, yes. So in some instances, civilians have been targeted by militant Islamist groups in the region. This tends to be kind of a reprisal type of dynamic in which you have local civilian-led militias that have emerged to sort of self-defense to try and protect their communities from these militant Islamist groups, which will at times, you know, enforce, arrive, and coerce sort of a taxation, a sort of extortion.
Military rulers who seized power in Burkina Faso in January said that they would make fighting these armed groups their top priority. How successful have they been?
I think, you know, sadly, they have not been very successful. They've pursued a few different changes in policy. Perhaps the most drastic one was to set up zones d'intérêt militaire, special military zones, where they effectively asked all Burkina Faso citizens that were living in those zones to leave And if they were, if, you know, they set a deadline for after that deadline, if anyone found in those zones, they would be considered hostile. And the idea was to sort of clear that territories.
That was Daniel Aizenga, an expert on the Sahel with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme. Libyan armed factions fought in the western outskirts of Tripoli late on Friday and early Saturday as forces aligned with Abdul Hamid Dabeba's government further consolidated control over the capital. The clashes, along with a major pro-Dabak group taking over a military headquarters in southern Tripoli, came a week after fighting dislodged several groups that had aligned with Dabeba rival Prime Minister Fethi Bashagha, who has been appointed by the Eastern-based parliament to head a new government. As Turkey held meetings with the two rival Libyan prime ministers, VOA senior analyst Mohammed Ashinawi discussed the latest round of fighting in Tripoli with Wolfgang Putsai, former Austrian military attachés in Libya.
The fighting at the end of August ended with the pro-Dabeba militias controlling most of Tripoli. Bashagha's prospects to sack Dabeba with military means are probably gone. During the last days, Rada Force, which had a decisive role in the fight against the pro-Bashagha militias at the end of August, conducted some mopping up operations against remaining elements of the so-called Tripoli Revolutionary Brigade in Ain Zara, in Tripoli southeast. This led to the withdrawal of what is left from this brigade from Tripoli last Saturday, early in the morning towards the west of Tripoli. So this Rada force controls now not only the center of Tripoli, but also several parts of the outskirts of Libya's capital. The clashes between the two Vishifana brigades west of Tripoli that you were referring to had less of a political background than a criminal one. This is about mainly dominance of the smuggling business. Ramzi Al-Lafa, one of the two brigade commanders, who is much weaker probably than the other, tried to strengthen his position with the help of pro-Dabeba militias in the wake of their victory, but this did not really work. With the arrival of the Tripoli Revolutionary Brigade in the Rishifana Brigade, there is now a relatively strong pro-Bashagha militia group in close proximity to Tripoli. On the other side, in Tripoli, the pro-Dabeba militia coalition is very inhomogeneous. They are just unified in their concern about Bashagha becoming prime minister and going after them, and of Dabeba's money. I'm pretty sure that we will see some more fighting in between them within some weeks.
During last week's fighting, both Bashagha and Dabeba have visited Turkey. Their visit has raised questions about Turkish designs in Libya, because Ankara was hoping to hold talks between the two Libyan heads of governments who are both allied with Turkey. Is that feasible?
I would say Turkey has now made up his mind in the struggle for Libya's prime minister. While Bashagha got just a meeting with some Turkish senior politicians behind closed doors without any media present or without any pictures taken, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received his rival Prime Minister Dabeba in Istanbul for official talks on the political, military and economic situation in Libya and on future cooperation. Erdogan, who has now shown clearly and officially his support for Dabeba through this meeting, urged Dabeba that Libya should adhere to its financial obligations towards Turkey. The Libyans are owing billions of US dollars to Turkey. He also stressed the importance of maintaining the unity of Libya, which is crucial for Turkey. After the meeting, a smiling Prime Minister Dabeba stated that there are now not two governments in Libya, but only one, his one, the government of national unity. I would say there is now only one government of practical relevance in Libya, the government of Dabeba.
Eight political parties in Libya established a communication network with an aim to present initiatives, proposals, and solutions to the current political impasse. And they aim to communicate with all actors locally and internationally in order to stress the role of Libyan political parties in building the democratic stable state based on a constitution approved by the people through a referendum. What's your take on that move?
This is certainly a very positive move. The more they are doing to organize themselves, the better it is. Political parties have a very important role in serious democracies, and this would be also the case in Libya. But the landscape of political parties there is not very well developed. Dozens of small parties have very limited significance. while in the 2012 GNC General National Congress elections, 80 seats out of 200 were for political parties. Parties were not even allowed to run in the 2014 House of Representatives elections. This contributed to the very splintered landscape in the House of Representatives, which makes it extremely difficult to find a consensus about anything. The international community should do more to help the establishment and the organization of some serious political parties in Libya. And this initiative belongs to this.
That was Wolfgang Puzai, former Austria military attaché in Libya, is speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Shenawi. Liz Truss officially became Britain's new prime minister today, before being selected yesterday to lead the Conservative Party and thus become prime minister. She had served as foreign secretary and also as the secretary for trade. Alex Vine is director of the Africa program at the British Policy Research Institute, Chatham House. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson today asked him how Africa might factor into Prime Minister Truss's foreign policy.
My sense is that the UK has, over recent years, rode back from an uplift of prioritisation of Africa that they intended to do, but because of the fiscal pressures of the COVID-19 pandemic, the ambition has had to be sharpened and focused. And so last year there was something called the Integrated Review, which was a vision of British foreign policy that was published. And there we see that basically Britain had decided, or the government had decided, should I say, to focus on East Africa. So there was a pivot of British policy towards East Africa, which meant the East African coast, countries like Kenya and Tanzania, but also the Horn of Africa, so Ethiopia and Sudan in particular. And that's where the UK at the moment stands in terms of its priorities. Liz Truss, who is currently, has just taken over as being Prime Minister, but was the Foreign Secretary, has indicated that she will review the Integrated Review. And so my hope is that there will be, therefore, a review on the importance of Africa in British foreign policy.
Now, as Foreign Secretary, Ms. Truss had spoken about strengthening the Commonwealth. Of course, that includes a number of African nations, including some that are not former British colonies. Do you see that as being one of her platforms or her goals?
So Liz Truss has only been to sub-Saharan Africa once in her career, and that was to Kigali, Rwanda, recently for the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit that occurred in early August. And so in theory, Conservative governments here have talked about the Commonwealth being a priority, particularly after leaving the European Union. Unfortunately, my sense is that there's been a lot of muddling through. And so there isn't really a clear strategy by British government for the Commonwealth currently. I'm hoping that maybe with Liz Truss there's an opportunity to really sharpen that focus and vision. As you say, it's not just a club of countries that are former colonies of the United Kingdom. In Kigali, just recently in August, two new members joined, and both have no connections with the former British Empire. So that's Togo and Gabon, both Francophone countries. So the Commonwealth is changing, and there are still a list of countries that want to join. For example, Angola, a former Portuguese colony, has also applied to join the Commonwealth.
Now, my last question for you is the issue of undocumented migration. That has been a growing issue in the UK, in the political structure in the UK. It involves relationships with the European neighbors. Also, there was the policy, which has sort of been put on hold, of deporting undocumented migrants to Rwanda. What's likely to happen there on that issue under Prime Minister Truss?
So In the hustings to be prime minister, including the very last one, she continued to defend the contested partnership with Rwanda to repatriate to Kigali informal migrants to the UK. So she has continued to say that this is a good policy and that she's going to see the end result, which is that informal migrants are deported from the United Kingdom to Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. We'll see. This has been contested by the courts. It's been problematized by the UN. I don't think it's a popular measure, particularly across the United Kingdom. And so maybe this is an area that she'll have to compromise.
That was Alex Vine, who heads the Africa program at Chatham House in London. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. The Constitutional Court of Angola has rejected a request by the opposition party, the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, to annul the August 24 presidential election result, which declared the ruling People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA, winner. But Luanda-based Angolan journalist Israel Campos tells me UNITA has a second petition to have the votes recounted, in which the Constitutional Court has yet to rule on.
We know that UNITA has appealed to the Constitutional Court to contest the Angola electoral results that give a win to the ruling MPLA. So one of the complaints has been rejected yesterday by the Constitutional Court, the one that they were asking for an annulment of the results from the National Electoral Commission. So that one has been rejected yesterday. And the document was signed by all the members, almost everyone being part of the constitutional court. So UNITA yesterday have given a press conference where President Adalberto Costa Jr. has again said that there is no trust in the results from the National Electoral Commission and that they will do everything in their power to make sure that the electoral truth remains.
You mentioned that one petition has been thrown out. It means the verdict is still not final. What is going to happen next regarding the other petition?
Well, it's still unclear on when the Constitutional Court is going to rule on the other petition from UNITA. We know that the National Electoral Commission has said yesterday, has advised the Constitutional Court to reject UNITA's complaints because they have said that they don't have any legal base on their complaints, because we need to understand that before UNITA went to the Constitutional Court, they did complain with the National Electoral Commission, which has rejected their complaints.
And just to refresh our memory, what is the second petition about, which the court has yet to rule on?
Well, UNITA is saying that, you know, they do not agree with the final results from the National Electoral Commission. They say that the accord, according to the reports they have, which we call atacinses, which are like the reports that come from the polling stations, they have not, the reports they have do not match with the ones that the National Electoral Commission has announced. So that's what they're asking in that petition for the Constitutional Court to reveal the counting of the votes, or allow there to be an independent structure to do the recounting of the votes. So that's what UNITA is looking for, because they say they have data, they have figures saying that the results from the National Electoral Commission are not the true ones.
Understood. So they're claiming discrepancies between their own tallying of the results and the tally they received from the Electoral Commission. So how are people receiving this outside the two parties? What is the mood in the street, in the streets of Angola, if you wish?
Well, it's important to say that there's still tension here in Angola. Earlier this week, yesterday, we learned that the army has been, put in high risk alert, and walking around Rwanda, you can see that many armed police and army staff are around the streets. So there's this this environment of where people are still really tense, just awaiting for the final outcome from the election. It's been almost 3 weeks. We're going to the third week after the 24th of August, where we held our elections. So people are still tense because they want to know what the final outcome, so that they can go and get along with their lives.
That was Angolan journalist Israel Campos speaking with me from the Angolan capital Luanda earlier today. The United Nations is calling for a significant and rapid scale-up of humanitarian assistance to prevent a famine in Somalia, and which could result in a devastating loss of life. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The latest UN Food and Nutritional Analysis released Monday warns more than a million people in the Bay region and south-central Somalia are on the verge of famine. That is the third drought facing Somalia in a decade. UNICEF Somalia representative Wafa Saeed says repercussions from the current drought will be disastrous if international support is not significant and immediate.
And this drought is actually worse than the drought of 2011, when we had 250,000 people lost their life, half of them children. It is worse because it is more in severity, it has lasted longer, and it's impacting larger areas. I've actually spoken to people who are over 70 years of age who told me that they have never seen such a bad drought in their lifetime.
The UN Children's Fund says malnutrition has reached crisis levels. It says 1.5 million children, nearly half of the under five population, are acutely malnourished. It warns some 385,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition are at risk of death without special nutritional treatment. Speaking in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, Saeed says some 730 children are reported to have died in food and nutrition centers across the country. She adds the number is probably higher because many deaths go unreported. She says the worsening malnutrition crisis, coupled with a worsening water and sanitation crisis, makes children particularly vulnerable to deadly outbreaks of disease.
We are really very much concerned about this because we are also seeing increase in outbreak of acute water diarrhea. There are more than 8,400 cases this year and around 13,000 cases of measles. And the cases of measles this year alone is more than what has been reported in 2020 and 2021 combined.
Another matter of concern is the large number of children likely to miss an education. UNICEF says more than 3 million children are directly affected by drought, and 900,000, half of them girls, are at risk of dropping out of school. It notes 90% of those who drop out never return to school. The UN Children's Agency says only 65% of its $112 million appeal is funded, and less than a third of the United Nations' overall appeal for $1 billion has been received. The agency says donors must step up and respond generously to this overarching emergency to stop the worst from happening. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Chad is battling what aid groups are calling catastrophic rains and floods. Reuters says thousands of people have left their inundated homes in the capital in N'Djamena in search of shelter. The wire service says among the hardest hit areas is the 8th district of the capital, where families use wooden boats to cross the street. Others have taken refuge in a local school or use sticks and cloth to create makeshift dwellings amid circling mosquitoes. Many lack food and some are ill with malaria. The city's mayor says an emergency crisis committee has been set up to provide food, blankets and health kits. A senior official with the state weather agency told Reuters that it is the most rainwater to hit the country since 1990. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and engineer Nelson Lopez, thank you for tuning in and for choosing the Voice of America.